Welcome to this ABI Media Teleconference on the General Motors Bankruptcy. I'm John Hartgen, ABI's Public Affairs Manager. This teleconference will feature a brief introduction, and then we will take your questions. As expected, GM filed for Chapter 11 on Monday as part of a government-steered restructuring with a $30 billion financial assistance package from the U.S. taxpayers on top of the $20 billion in emergency aid already extended. More than 235,000 auto workers, nearly 500,000 retirees, 11,000 vendors, and 3,600 GM dealers are affected. Under the plan, the government will receive 60% of GM stock in a new company, while the Canadian government will receive a 12% stake for its loan infusion. GM hopes to exit bankruptcy in 60 to 90 days after a fast sale under Section 363, now that a majority of the bondholders have agreed to trade debt for 10% equity in the new GM. The UAW Trust Fund will own 17.5% of the new GM. The old GM will be wound down, with brands sold off, plants closed, and dealers terminated. Late Sunday night, the bankruptcy court in New York approved the sale of Chrysler to a new company managed by Fiat in another government-planned bankruptcy. To discuss these so-called surgical bankruptcies and their implications, we have assembled a panel of experts, including Peter S. Kaufman, a managing director of Gordian Group in New York. Peter is president and head of Gordian's Restructuring and Distressed Mergers and Acquisitions Practice. Skylar G. Carroll is a partner in the Bankruptcy and Financial Restructuring Group of Aaron Fox. His practice focuses on complex restructuring, transaction, litigation, and advisory work, particularly representing creditors' committees. Professor Stephen J. Lubin is the Daniel J. Moore Professor of Law at Seton Hall University School of Law. Professor Lubin specializes in corporate finance, particularly in issues concerning corporate debt and financial distress. Cheryl L. Toby serves as the co-chair of Dyke McGossett's Bankruptcy and Corporate Restructuring Group in Detroit, where she is a bankruptcy and restructuring attorney with more than 20 years in the field, serving in the firm's automobile industry practice area. Now that the quake of the filing has taken place, with GM expected to emerge in 60 to 90 days, I'd like to present the panel and kicking it off and handing it over to Peter Kaufman. What are some of the likely aftershocks that will last longer in this proceeding? And I'd like to hand the call now to Peter Kaufman.
John, thank you. Good morning to the callers, and it's a pleasure to be here with these august fellow panelists. I'm sure we'll get into on this call what may happen in the GM case, but I'm going to address your question head on, John. I think that there has been, between Chrysler and now GM, with what the government is seeking to do in GM and what it appears that it will get done in Chrysler, is going to have real systemic implications for bankruptcy and for financings in this country. Taking the second part first, lenders, the reason that America has always been the most welcoming place for capital, particularly loans, entities looking to loan money, banks, bondholders, et cetera, is because everyone knows what their downside is, because we have the world's most well-established, clear set of bankruptcy laws and case laws underpinning the bankruptcy code. Now that has all been stood on its ear between what happened in Chrysler and what is being sought in General Motors. And we'll get into, you know, the issues there. But I think the result of all this is, no matter what happens in GM, whether it gets slammed through or whether this time, unlike Chrysler, dissenting bondholders get the court's attention and, get in the way of what's happening here, I think that you're going to find, at a time when this country needs capital more than ever, needs capital providers more than ever, you're going to find institutions with their hands in their pockets, or they're going to be charging an awful lot more than they otherwise would have, because suddenly they don't know their downside anymore, because the bankruptcy laws are being stood on their ear. And specifically in General Motors, you've got arguably similarly situated creditors, unsecured creditors, the unions, and the bondholders, and the unions are palpably, by up to three or four times, being preferred in their value recovery over over the bondholders. And the reason for that is because the government apparently has a policy goal that it wants to prefer the unions and take care of them in order to get GM out of bankruptcy quickly. And so I think that that's going to be a systemic issue on a go-forward basis.
And, John, can I jump in on that?
Certainly.
This is Stephen Lubin. I just wanted to present my counter view on that, because, I mean, I've heard this argument a lot. I think the thing people need to keep in mind with regard to the unions, however, is that the money that is going to the unions, or the recovery that's going to the unions, because it's not actually cash in most cases, is not a recovery that would be on the table for creditors in a normal bankruptcy. I think the better way to view the recovery that's going to the unions is a government bailout to the unions, and we can debate whether or not that's a good idea. But I think it's kind of a little misleading to suggest that that money or that recovery would otherwise be available for creditors to get.
Thank you, Professor Lubin.
And Stephen, if I could jump in, it's Skylar Carroll. I think you raise a very good point. It's important to look at the Chrysler and GM cases in focus and not in a vacuum. If we simply said these were plans or sales that were set up and these constituencies, i.e. the unions and others, including, frankly, the suppliers, were getting what they're getting in a normal case, it would be very easy to say that the system would be challenged and it would likely to have very significant changes down the road, because every party would come in and say, hey, wait a second, look at those cases. Those are precedent. I am similarly situated to those parties, and I should get the same legal benefit. But the reality is that's not what's happening. These are two cases that are being run by the government and are being supported by the government, which doesn't mean the government can't do it again, but to look at these as precedent for anything else, I think, is overstating the case.
All right, well, this is Peter. Let me defend myself quickly, and then I'll cede the microphone to Cheryl. Number one, if I'm a capital provider or a putative capital provider here going forward, I will be incredibly concerned about putting money in where there's a union or where there's conceivably a government policy interest now or down the road, because Skylar's, to paraphrase Skylar, is saying, well, gee, this is a special circumstance, and that's right. Until it is again, until the government again decides that there's a special circumstance. And with respect to Professor Lubin, I would offer this. I guess the government can give out whatever bailouts it wants to whatever groups it wants, but A, I think we should just all label it what the professor correctly did, which is a bailout for the unions here, not a restructuring of GM per se. But number two, if you're going to utilize the bankruptcy courts of this country and the bankruptcy laws of this country, then you ought to be observing the bankruptcy laws of this country. If they want to do something outside the bankruptcy court with taxpayer money, have at it. But to use the bankruptcy court and then trample bankruptcy law is something that I think has systemic issues.
How does the payment to the unions violate the bankruptcy law? That's the question I've never really gotten a straight answer to.
I'm glad to answer that one. The unions are getting about $10 billion in set-aside assets. They're getting a note. They're getting preferred stock that comes ahead of all of the new shares, and they're getting 17.5% of the stock. The bondholders, and that's in return for their unsecured claim.
But aren't they getting all that stuff from the purchaser? Now, which I admit is a fiction for the government.
Let me step back. This is a plan of reorganization. It's called a sub rosa plan through a 363, which is verboten under the bankruptcy law. And so you've got how much are the unions owed? I forgot here. $20 billion, something like that. And in return for that, they're getting all those goodies. And they're getting $10 billion in set-aside assets. They have about a $35 billion claim. They're getting $10 billion in set-aside assets. They're getting a note for a couple billion. They're getting a $6.5 billion preferred piece of paper, which is going to pay them $600 million a year, and they're getting 17.5% of the stock. The unsecured claim of the bondholders is $27 million, and all they're getting is 10% of the stock. So it's patently unequal treatment, and it's a sub rosa plan being promulgated through a 363, all of which, if you're going to utilize the bankruptcy court, shouldn't you you know, adhere to the rules of the bankruptcy code? My answer is yes.
Yes, and just wanted to see with Cheryl, you're there at Ground Zero in Detroit. What is your perspective of the overall aftershocks and implications of the GM filing?
Yeah, my focus is more on the practicality. Listening to these debates, it's clear that we're going to be having academic debates at things like the prestigious ABI conferences, and whether it has a practical, immediate impact on bankruptcy law is yet to be seen. And again, that'll be more academic and judge-driven to some extent. But the practical aftershocks, of course, being in Detroit, as you said, I'm a little bit more focused on, and to me, the big issues really come out on the play out on the impact on the supplier base, which could be extensive. And I don't think that anybody has a full handle on the impact or could have a full handle on the impact on what that's going to have, which could impact thousands of other companies. And that obviously is a very significant practical concern. As these brands are sold, as brands are shut down, certain lines are shut down, that has significant impact on suppliers, which supply to, in effect, many of them to all the auto companies. And when you take out a portion of their business, it impacts the ability to maintain manufacturing processes for the rest of the good brands, so to speak, and or the other brands. And so we're going to be seeing a lot of economic fallout and continued concern over the supply base and the company's ability to continue to operate.
Well, this is Peter. I'm so glad Cheryl raised that point, because it raises something else, John, with your permission, I'd like to get into, which is all of those good, true issues that Cheryl's raising is not caused per se by General Motors filing for Chapter 11 on Monday. It's caused by the fact that General Motors failed. So I just want to make it clear to the audience that it's not, gee, the bankruptcy caused all this hardship. It's that General Motors failed. It's a failed business model. They're trying to, you know, breathe life into some, you know, successor of it. But the bankruptcy is the result of all that. It's not the cause of this pain.
Okay. Thank you for that note there, Peter. And let me see, before we open it to question and answer here, any additional points you'd like to raise? Okay, well, Jessica, I would like to give you the opportunity to allow our audience the dial-in instructions so that they can ask their questions of our panel.
Yes, sir. For our phone audience, if you'd like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please ensure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that is star 1 if you have a question. We'll go first to Justin Hine with Detroit Free Press.
Go ahead, Justin.
Hello, John. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Justin.
Okay. I guess my first question is for Mr. Kaufman. Are you saying that in a situation where you have a restructuring plan and several pari passu debtors, that the purchaser can't decide whether to reward one group of creditors over another to a greater degree? My second question is more broadly, say this is some sort of sub rosa plan, is there any way for any of an objector to simply object and stop the plan, or would that objector have to be able to offer some sort of viable alternative?
Thanks, Justin. And it's Peter, not Mister. Nice to talk to you again. With respect to your first question, yes, I'm saying that you are a purchaser of assets is not really permitted under the law to provide treatment for various unsecured creditors who are all pari passu and treat them differently. You know, you occasionally will be able to take care of some trade creditors in a special way. You can't go in and give plan of reorganization treatment and do it disparately through a Section 363 sale. Now, what was the other part of your question?
Hello, Justin.
Hello, John.
Yes. Hello.
Oh, hi. Sorry, I'm back. It was a question about who could object if it is a sub rosa plan, who has the standing to object, and do you need to be able to offer a viable alternative in order to sustain an objection?
A party in interest can object, and no, you don't have to offer a viable alternative.
All right.
John, this is Skyler. If I could take a crack at it as well.
Certainly.
To answer the second part of the question, certainly you don't have to offer an alternative to object. I think the practical concern here to somebody who's objecting, however, is that if you don't offer an alternative, this is a train that is moving down the tracks. And everybody else but the one or hundreds of people that are objecting, but in the scheme of things, even those hundreds of people are really minor, are towing the ropes and going in the same direction, including the government. And everyone knows what the end game is. Everyone knows they want to get there. And if you can offer an alternative to everyone that makes sense, people may be able to be willing to get off the track and get on your train. But without that, you have a simple legal issue, and the court's going to decide it more than likely, regardless of what the law is. Judges know how to get to the result they want to and are likely to do that. Having said that, frankly, Judge Gerber is a judge who enforces the law very strictly. Judge Gerber goes through very, very detailed analysis and will spend all the time that's necessary in getting to what he believes is the right result. And if there is a judge who believes the law is the law, and even if this is good for the country, my job is to enforce the law. Congress is the one who's to change the law. It may very well be Judge Gerber, so we may see that put to the test.
Yeah, and I think here it would be actually quite simple to get to fealty to the law and fairness and still get the transaction the government wants, and that is throw all the consideration in a pot and let the courts more leisurely decide who gets what, but get the bankruptcy out, you know, get the company out into the government's hands ASAP, and you can divide the pot up more leisurely. And to Skyler, you know, in response to two things Skyler said, number one, it's not a few people likely objecting. Only 54% of the bonds said they like this deal, which I think means that 46% of $27 billion are not supportive of this. That's a big chunk of people who, if they mobilize, they've got some great legal arguments, and I think that there is a way to move this thing ahead the way the government wants and still, you know, get fairness here. And I would also point everybody to the Braniff case, which was in 1982 or 1983, where there was a sub rosa plan under the guise of a 363 sale, and it flew through bankruptcy court. It was appealed to the district court. District court upheld it. It was appealed to the Circuit Court of Appeals, I think in Chicago, and the Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, we're not going to allow a sub rosa plan under the guise of a 363. And I think that may be the dispositive case here that people are going to be looking at.
This is Stephen Lubin. If I can jump in on that, I would note, however, that the Braniff case has never really been the law in the Second Circuit. Lionel has been really the case about 363 sales in the Second Circuit. I also would point out that, you know, the law, as Peter stated in his original comment, is probably not quite as clear as he suggested, because there are a fair number of cases that talk about what's known as a gift plan. And we do have in this case about, I think it's $27 billion of secured debt, and the debtor's coming out with a liquidation analysis that's suggesting GM's assets are worth at most about $10 billion. So there's even an argument here that the bondholders, you know, no matter how many of them object, may not even be in the money and may be actually being overcompensated with their 10%.
Oh, but if they're pari passu with the union, that would say the union is too.
Well, but the union, again, I mean, this goes back to that debate about whether the consideration that's going to the union is actually money that's in the estate, and I argue that it's not, so it's kind of irrelevant to the discussion.
Well, I think we can all agree that in a liquidation, the bondholders get nothing and the union gets nothing. So that's my starting point.
The union gets nothing from the estate, but they might still get the same bailout from the government.
Okay. Well, appreciate those points. And I just wanted to check to see, are there additional questions in the queue, Jessica?
Yes, we do have a question from Scott Horsley with National Public Radio.
Okay.
Hi. I'm just wondering if that battle was waged in the Chrysler case, or if there's a reason to think it'll be different this time around.
This is Stephen Lemon. I believe it was raised in the Chrysler case, and I guess you can infer from the entry of the order that Judge Gonzalez agreed with me more than he agreed with Peter.
Well, actually, there was a different issue in Chrysler. The Chrysler issue precisely is that the unsecured creditors, the unions, were getting more than the secured bondholders. So it's not a disparate treatment of similarly situated creditors. It's junior creditors are getting more than senior secured creditors.
Which is arguably actually a stronger position.
And you may recall that the dissenting senior secured bondholders were vilified by President Obama in a press conference. A lot of pressure was brought to bear on them, and they folded their tents and went away, except for the Indiana pension funds, who represent such Wall Street fat cats like retired Indiana policemen, retired Indiana high school teachers, etc. They have got about 43 million of pension funds in Chrysler, and they appealed. And their appeal is still ongoing. Judge Gonzalez, I guess a day or so ago, gave them permission to skip the district court and go straight to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals to appeal it. So, in fact, the game isn't yet over in Chrysler, just to be precise.
And, Professor Levin, could you just kind of explain your reasoning that the sop to the union is coming from the government as opposed to from the estate? In what way?
Because it's money that the government is putting into the, in both cases, it's money that the, or consideration that the government's putting into this purchaser that is then being transferred to the unions. It's not a recovery that was ever in the estate in the first place. I agree that it's a bailout to the unions and it may be bad policy, but that's kind of a separate debate to me. Only the consideration for the sale that goes into the estate is part of the estate, and that is actually not being divided up in either of these cases ahead of time. It's just that we kind of know where it's going to go, because in Chrysler, for example, $2 billion of cash go into the estate. Well, the secured lenders are owed $6.9 billion. We know who's going to get the $2 billion of cash.
Stephen, it's Skylar Carroll. I would amplify one point that you made. The majority of what the unions are getting are actually the stock in the new company, which clearly is not something that the estate, the current GM, actually owns. So the new company that is buying GM's assets can give that stock to anyone they want, and that's really the argument, or the second half of the argument, on why it doesn't violate the bankruptcy code. Now, Peter's response to that, which is a completely reasonable one, is, yeah, but the reality is all they're doing is setting up a new company so they can avoid the bankruptcy code restrictions. So that's the tension back and forth there.
And that's exactly right, and I would add one thing, and I'd really like to hear what Cheryl's views are. But in any case where there's a third-party purchaser, in most of them, it's an arm's-length third-party purchaser. There isn't any consideration in the estate until the third party puts it in. So I find that I don't get that argument in all candor. That this is true in every 363. The money's not in there until the third party brings it to the table. Same here. I'm sorry, Cheryl.
Yeah, no, my view is that, frankly, this isn't a brand new issue by any means. And with the type of economics we've been facing in bankruptcy cases in the last year, we've been seeing these kind of cases. But, of course, they haven't gotten the same type of media attention on a smaller basis, because the fact of the matter is many of the purchasers, the purchase prices are well below the amount to pay even the secured debt, and there aren't distributions, and the plant and the 363 sale provisions are providing for the manner and distribution of those amounts. And I think it has become an unfortunate sort of scenario within the bankruptcy concept based on the economics. So, A, I don't think it's all that unusual, although, on the other hand, this is, I'm going to contradict myself in saying that, on the other hand, these, of course, are unusual cases in the sense of the government support, making it a little different. The other thing is, it is not, we can argue whether those monies are coming out of estate funds or not versus being put in new in the stock being distributed by the purchaser and therefore was never assets of the estate, and I understand Peter's argument to the contrary. But it should be known that within bankruptcy, we also, out-of-estate assets, often prefer some creditors over others based on the realities and practicalities of being able to continue to allow companies to operate. For example, wages. We pay all the wages. They're capped. They're typically, when a company files bankruptcy, they may owe pre-petition wages to creditors that would still be treated as an unsecured debt, although they may have administrative priority up to a certain amount. We pay them so that we know we still have workers. We are paying suppliers, in this case, that are providing the goods and services to this company. That is obviously the critical supplier orders are common in bankruptcy. That's money coming out of the estate to pay a certain set of creditors so that we can keep operating. And so it's not a complete shock or anything completely new to the bankruptcy process as to what's being proposed or done here.
Cheryl, you're reinforcing the point I made earlier, but you're getting to a different conclusion. We're both saying that it's customary, even in a 363, to pay, you know, employee pre-existing claims and what I call critical, you know, vendors, the suppliers that you need to keep the doors open. What is absolutely not customary, unless you're going to point me to a bunch of things of which I'm unaware, which is very possible, to treat capital structure claimants differently in a 363. That is absolutely not customary.
But you're not talking about capital crime. You're talking about, you were talking about unions and not
They are general unsecured creditors, just
correct,
like the bondholders.
And just like critical supplier, unsecured suppliers,
the union and others.
Are getting paid out of assets of the estate directly during the bankruptcy process, not out of the new money coming in
assets. The union health plan, which is getting all the goodies, is an unsecured creditor, and I can't help but wonder what is critical about paying them through the 363 disparately than other unsecured creditors versus trade vendors who you need to keep the doors open and employees you need to keep the doors open. There's a huge distinction there.
Well, I think obviously this is these are going to be fun academic debates for a while.
This is very true, and we can circle back to this point. But I wanted to check with Jessica if there were any other questions in the queue.
Not at the moment, but I'd like to remind our phone audience that it is *1 if you have a question.
Okay, thank you, Jessica. And Professor Lubin, you were about to raise a point.
Yeah, I think this may actually kind of amplify one of the points that was just made. Imagine if Chrysler, instead of it being the government buying them out, had been a bank. So a secured bank credit bids $2 billion, and they take Chrysler's assets. We would never know after that sale happened if they decided that they were going to basically pay what amounts to, you know, some payoff money to the unions to keep everybody happy after the sale. We wouldn't know. We know here because it's the government doing it, and they've been, you know, kind of upfront about what their larger plan is. But, I mean, that's essentially the structure of this deal, right? Somebody buys Chrysler, and then after the sale, they make a payment to the unions to buy some piece. I don't see how, if that was a bank doing it, it would be a problem. So I think we need to disentangle the, you know, our own personal views about, you know, the government involvement here from the analysis.
Is that right, Skylar? Cheryl, you agree that if a bank did that, that's fine. That's not violative of bankruptcy law.
I think there is a little difference here in that it's being done in the as a being approved in an order versus,
right,
as he said, you sell it, you buy it, and then you give away your stock or whatever. I do see cases outside this case in which that is being done.
Yeah, I do agree that I think in both the bidding procedures and the order there has been some overreaching. But I don't think the basic structure of the deal is nearly as shocking and objectionable as it's been suggested.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you in this, Skylar Carroll. The reality is what's happened over the last few years, and particularly over the last 6 to 9 months, is we've seen a sea change from the days of the early 90s in Braniff, where people actually objected successfully to sales, and now where just the opposite is the case. I would say almost every case that is filed in the recent months has been one of two things, either a sale that has a signed agreement on the day they file bankruptcy and is expected to close in less than 60 days, or a liquidation. And the sale cases are all very structured and very smoothly set out, and it really is a big difference from what you used to see. So I think maybe the next question for, and maybe not this group, but for people in general to consider is whether that's a good thing, and whether, one group is actually trying to lobby Congress to consider changing that and going back to the old mechanism where a plan was really the only way you could move forward.
Well, I guess I'm going to ask you a follow-up question, Skylar. This is Peter. Is it your contention that 363 sales are both routine and they allocate consideration amongst the capital structure, aka a sub rosa plan, the way Chrysler and GM do?
I would say the answer to the first one is absolutely yes. They are clearly routine,
right,
and clearly routinely approved. I would say that in certain cases, probably less than 20%, the deals do have some aspect of allocating capital. I definitely do not believe that it is the majority that you see the way there is fully allocated out here on the 24th, the Chrysler GM scale. But I've seen, like I said, probably about less than 20% where there's some party that, for whatever reason, the buyer wants to curry favor with, and that party is getting something that they otherwise wouldn't be down the road.
Yeah, I'm going to say that there's pretty much 0% of 363 cases where the consideration comes in and all of the claimants and interest holders, unsecured creditors, stockholders, etc., get full treatment through the 363 plan, other than Chrysler and General Motors.
I've got one right now, Peter. I can't say which one, unfortunately, but there's one right now that just got approved yesterday.
Okay.
I'll put out one example, and it's in a published opinion, and it's the Iridium case in the Second Circuit. I mean, the court actually, in that opinion, says it was not a sub rosa plan, even though the way the settlement was working was all the money was going to the secured lenders, except for there was a carve-out that was going to go down to the unsecured creditors so that they could fund recovery actions. They were bypassing Motorola, which was the complaining creditor in the middle there.
And did the shareholders get anything?
Shareholders didn't get anything.
Okay, well, here everybody is being treated through the 363, and that is absolutely a sub rosa plan. So, I mean, if people want to say, we're going to lift the leg on, not permitting sub rosa plans, that's fine. I'm just pointing out that this is not business as usual. It's not even business as sometimes.
I would say I think it's business as usual in the Southern District and Delaware.
Okay.
I'll go out on a limb and say that.
Just to interject here, wanted to check with Jessica. Are there any questions in the queue from our audience?
Yes, sir. We'll go back to Scott Horsling with National Public Radio.
Go ahead,
thanks,
Scott.
Thanks for a second turn. It was mentioned earlier that the Braniff case isn't really the law in the district, but the Lionel case is. And can you just say what that case was and what it stood for?
It's an opinion from the early 80s, as I recall, involving the Lionel Train Company, Model Train Company. And basically the rule coming out of that case is that the debtor has to have a good business reason or exercise good business judgment to decide to sell the assets early. The opinion kind of rejects older pre-1978 cases that suggest you have to have a melting ice cube kind of scenario.
Yeah, Professor, you're much more conversant with Lionel. I used to be. Did Lionel address sub rosa plan issues? I didn't recall that it did, but if you tell me.
It doesn't in the degree Braniff does. It addresses similar considerations. Like, it does make some mention of, you know, we want to be careful about not totally doing an end run around 1129 through the plan process. But the standard that's ultimately adopted is much, much lower than Braniff. And I wouldn't point out that the Second Circuit had actually never cited Braniff until the recent Iridium case, but then again, as I just said, it cited it and then found that plan wasn't a sub rosa plan. So the standard for sub rosa plan seems to be somewhat weaker in the Southern District, which is no doubt part of the reason why they piled there.
And by melting ice cube, do you mean a business that's losing value minute by minute and time is of the essence?
Yeah, the pre-1978 cases kind of suggested that you could only do a pre-planned sale in a situation where, like, if you had a produce vendor and, you know, the produce was all rotting in the warehouse kind of scenario.
Okay. And, Jessica, are there any other questions in the queue?
There are no further questions at this time, sir.
Okay. I'd like to raise a question to all the speakers here on the call. Skyler, you brought up about how most cases are either a 363 sale or straight liquidation, and that, would you all say, is more a product of the current financing environment, and what you see the ramifications and implications of the government being a primary dip lender, I guess, just to paraphrase, would that be something you see as a continuing trend in Chapter 11 cases, given that current constricting of the financing environment?
Well, I think, and this is Skyler Carroll, I think that if we do see that as a continuing trend, we're in a lot greater trouble than it may appear. One of the biggest reasons the government has stepped into GM and Chrysler and so many of the banks is to ensure that things don't continue to slide. And if the government has to continue to step in, that would be, to me, a sign that their efforts have not gone the right way, and it's going to be a much bigger problem. So I would certainly hope it's not a sign of things to come, probably a sign of things to come from the legal standpoint, where people will try to use this as precedent. But in terms of the capital providers, hopefully it's a sign that maybe the tide is going in the right direction. We're over the worst of it. The government has stepped in to stave things, and now we can move forward and the banks can do what they think is necessary.
Okay, thank you. And the rest of the panel, what are your thoughts on the particular implications right now of these cases on private equity? If you'd like to address that, I know that you talked about the strong-arming of the bondholders in the Chrysler case, but just overall general implications. I'd like to hand that one to Peter and then allow Professor Levin and Cheryl to give their views as well.
Well, you know, there are a couple things. I'm standing by my statement, which is my belief that the implication here is that private capital providers are going to be incredibly wary of providing money where there's either a union involved or a conceivable government policy interest, number one. Number two, I find it astonishing that we're going to commit, you know, up to $100 billion for General Motors, potentially, when private capital doesn't want to put in a dime. You know, private capital's greedy like the next, you know, like the next person, and yet it's only taxpayer dollars that are coming in here. I think this has been mishandled from the start. I think, you know, I was publicly advocating insolvency proceedings last October and November for these auto companies, and instead the government, both administrations, violated a cardinal rule. As I write, you know, write in my book, how's that for a plug? Distressed investment banking to the abyss and back. A cardinal rule of our business in investment banking is you don't put in new money to a troubled situation unless all the problems are being solved. Here, the government threw $20 billion down a rat hole, and we're still in bankruptcy, and now we've got to spend another 30, and if the business plan doesn't start being profitable, and who knows about that, then we could have to spend up to another $50 billion are the estimates. And I think that when you've got a venture that private capital, even today, doesn't find appealing with a retooled capital structure, et cetera, I would find that disturbing. But systemically, I still believe that you're going to there are going to be some real ramifications here.
Okay, and
but Peter, I mean, when you're loaning as I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please go right ahead, Cheryl.
When you're loaning on a private basis, you're right. You're only looking at recovery opportunities with respect to that loan, not on the overall economic implications for the country. The government has a different interest.
I'm sorry. General Motors is one company, and it's got a
it's
union.
It's not one company, Peter. It has huge implications upon lots of other companies, and that's what's being missed.
Well, no, I don't think that's being missed. But this goes back to what I was arguing with you before, or discussing with you before, which is General Motors has failed, and that failure is what has rippled down through all of the supplier bases and customers and everything else that you correctly talked about. It's not the bankruptcy, and it's not what the government is doing with the bondholders here. It's the fact that General Motors failed, and I think that if you have another wonderful debate about is up to $100 billion of taxpayer money better served trying to revive GM in some way, shape, or form, or better used to try and ameliorate the fallout of a liquidation of General Motors. But I still believe that anybody who's going to loan money in any of these situations that has a union or a potential government policy are going to be thinking twice. If you disagree, then we're just going to disagree.
We don't know how that implicates. I understand that somebody loaning into something that's going to be a high profile government interest.
Well, when somebody bought bonds in General Motors,
but we don't, none of us know in the entire economic implications, and the studies that have been done, of course, only go through even the supplier base. But I know, for example, in dealing with things I'm dealing with day in, day out, of course, many of these suppliers also supply to other manufacturing sectors of the industry. Some of the auto suppliers are not strictly auto suppliers. They don't just supply to auto. They supply to other manufacturing entities. Their inability to operate can have significant reaches, their tentacles can reach quite far. And therefore, like I said, a private industry has a much different interest when it makes a loan and it's recovering its interest or other types of set economic amounts from that amount being loaned versus dealing with the country's overall economic implications.
Well, but let's put this in the right perspective. Do you think that 5 years ago when somebody invested in bonds in General Motors, they thought they were investing in a whole systemic nationwide economic thing? Or did they think that they were getting some nice safe bonds that were going to pay 6% interest? I know what the answer is. It's the latter. So, I think that anybody who's going to think about providing capital here is going to have legitimate concerns about what happens in the downside given what's happened here. That's just my own view, and everyone can have their own views.
But you didn't have those same views on the Wall Street bailout.
Well, you haven't asked me about my views.
I heard your speeches too.
You haven't heard my views on Wall Street.
Jealous remaining on topic. Well, Professor Levin, what about your views on the overall financing environment? Weighing that versus the point that Cheryl raises as well, the overall ecosystem of an industry as well being affected. What are your thoughts on the future of both? With regard to these proceedings?
Well, I'm going to agree with Peter on one point, and that is that GM should have filed for Chapter 11 a long time ago. probably a couple of years ago when it could have done this as a regular Chapter 11 case, as regular as a case of that size could ever be. And I really blame the management, you know, for putting down, you know, these statements like, you know, that Chapter 11 was not an option. It clearly had to be an option, and it was clearly the wrong choice. That being said, I think that we have to also recognize that both Chrysler and GM were highly political cases. There was no politician, you know, no matter who won the election, no politician was going to allow a company like GM that's, you know, the source of retirement funds for 500,000 people, employs about 90,000 people. There's just no politician who was going to let that company fail, especially in the current economic environment, because it would just exacerbate the economic situation. So while I do agree with Peter somewhat that there'll probably be a short-term effect on financing because people will be a little gun-shy, I think eventually people are going to come around to the realization that these were cases on the order of like Penn Central was back in the early 1970s. They're not really normal bankruptcy cases.
Okay. And I'd like to discuss this point further, but I want to check in with Jessica. Are there any questions in the queue?
Yes, sir. We have a question from Alex Stewart with CFO Publishing.
Go ahead, Alex.
Thank you. Hi. I've heard a lot about how the changes in the bankruptcy law in 2005 might come to bear in this round of bankruptcies in general, and I was just curious to what extent GM and Chrysler might be affected by them.
Okay, to kick this off, let me see. Skyler, would you like to take the lead-off position and address
it? Sure, John, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
The two of the most important changes as relevant here are timing ones and just in a general sense, the bankruptcy code changes in 2005 made it much more difficult to extend a case, the life of a case for several years as you used to see with cases like Dow and Johns Manville, cases that went on for years and years and years. And also the requirement to pay certain suppliers that provided goods within the 20 days prior to the filing. There are a couple of other ones, but their general effect are more limited for purposes of GM and Chrysler. And the reality is, in the scheme of these cases, this would have precluded a bankruptcy, as Professor Lubin was referring to, the plain old, okay, we know we have major problems, we need to figure it out, we do not know whether it's going to be possible to do that, let's get into bankruptcy, let's get everybody to the table, let's beat people up until they agree to something reasonable and go forward. It would have been difficult to do that absent outside forces in 2 years, 2 or 3 years ago to get all those people to the table in a timetable that is required under the code now. Difficult, not impossible. The other side of it, the requirement to pay, is pretty much irrelevant because the government supply programs and the critical vendor motions are primarily paying all of those people anyway.
Okay, and any of our other panelists have a view on the question?
This is Stephen Levin. One thing I would add, though, is I do think that that summary is absolutely right, although I think GM is so large that you could doubt as to whether anyone would actually come up with an alternative plan, so exclusivity might not be quite as much of an issue in that size of a case.
Okay, thank you, Professor Levin. Anyone else? Okay, Jessica, just wanted to check, are there any other questions in the queue?
There are no further questions at this time.
Okay, and I see we're just about approaching the hour here. And as you all who have joined us today have heard, there are a lot of views, a lot of opinions on the matter, especially even among the bankruptcy experts. But right now, I'd like to conclude the call by breaking out the crystal ball for these speakers joining us today to see what they think will unfold in regards to the GM bankruptcy. Obviously, there's a plan that is laid out, but some of the ramifications, implications, as well as what they think will be coming down the line that you might not see within that plan. And so I'd like to hand the ball over to Peter to get his final views as to what he foresees shaping up with this case and some of the things that might not have been discussed.
I think that this government motors will emerge, you know, in a couple months. My dark horse prediction is that if there's a vigorous, effective, arguments raised along the lines I've been outlining, that there'll either be a recut deal amongst the unions of the bondholders or potentially a higher court might intercede here, but that's a very dark horse prediction. I think that the government's going to get what it wants here.
Okay, and Skyler, what about yourself? Any outside forces coming into play that might derail this process, or do you see this going as the plan is laid out as well?
In short, I think I agree 100% with Peter. It's certainly possible you could have a sort of an interim result that is different than Chrysler, which would be perhaps the judge considers it one of the issues more important and will not approve the sale absent some term changing. But I think overall it will be a very quick and relatively easy process.
Okay. And Professor Lubin, your thoughts on these unprecedented cases?
I tend to agree with what's been said. I think, like Chrysler, GM will probably get out relatively quickly. I was on Fox News last night, and they asked me almost the exact same question, so I have kind of an advantage here. My further thought, though, is that whether or not the GM or case is successful in the long run will a lot will depend on whether or not management has really changed at GM. I mean, those of us of a certain age, probably have really bad experiences with GM. They've alienated a couple of generations of buyers, and I think the GM management has to not only talk the talk this time, but make sure that they actually, reinvent themselves this time around. Because I agree with something that GM CEO said on that first day press conference. This is just their one chance at this. If it doesn't work out this time, the politicians will have given them their shot, and I don't think they get a second bite at this apple.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Lubin. And turning to Cheryl, just to your thoughts on how this proceeding will go, and importantly to the point you raised earlier, the effect on the ecosystem there in Detroit and the suppliers. What are your thoughts on that may be resulting from this proceeding?
Well, I agree with the comments of everybody else on the exit of this case being successful, but the implications on other companies will take a while to play out, and it's not just Detroit. It really is not. It has a much greater global reach overall, and that'll take some time.
Okay. And just before we conclude the call, I wanted to check with Jessica. Are there any last-minute questions in the queue for our panelists?
There are no further questions, sir.
Okay. Thank you. And, well, just to conclude, I'd like to thank all the participants who joined the call today. And most importantly, I'd like to thank our four speakers here today, Peter, Skyler, Professor Lubin, and Cheryl, for taking time out of their busy schedules to take your questions and present their views on the General Motors case. Thank you all. It is very most appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for including me.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to conclude this ABI teleconference. And would like to say that if you have any questions related to the General Motors case or bankruptcy in general, feel free to contact ABI at any time, and we look forward to offering you future ABI media presentations. Thank you very much. This concludes the teleconference.